Hello everyone, it's Helena here in Truro, Cornwall, here to talk about another masterpiece in the National Gallery's collection. This time, it's one of the most beautiful survivals of medieval art in England. It's the Wilton Diptych, and it dates 1395 to 1399. Diptych means two parts, and it is a two-part altar panel piece that is hinged at the centre, could be folded like a book, and carried from chapel to chapel, so it's portable prayer. Each panel, made of oak wood, measures approximately 47 by 29 centimetres, so given its compact size, it was probably designed for personal devotion. The reason why it's called the Wilton Diptych is from sometime in the early 1700s until it was acquired by the National Gallery in 1929. It resided at Wilton House in Wiltshire, the family seat of the Earls of Pembroke. Now, the Wilton Diptych is not only one of the most beautiful paintings ever made, it is also one of the most enigmatic. Because on the one hand, it is a straightforward representation of what is described in its long title. Richard II presented to the Virgin and Child by his patron St John the Baptist and Saints Edward and Edmund. But there are details contained in the picture which suggest there is much more to it than first meets the eye. And it's when we start to explore the deeper meanings of the painting that we start to encounter problems. Because questions are raised that we can't answer for sure. For a start, we don't know who painted the diptych. It could have been a French artist, it could have been an English artist, or a collaboration between the two. We don't know who the patron was, so we don't know the motives behind its commission. And there are features of the painting which are difficult to interpret. To give one example, is Richard II raising his hands in a gesture of prayer, or reception, or donation? Or is he doing all three, depending on how you interpret the painting? Art historians have tried to work out the meaning of the picture using details contained within it and also by drawing upon outside sources such as illuminated manuscripts, paintings, sculpture, jewellery and documents of the time. And this has led to a wide range of theories being put forward about the diptych. And in this discussion, I'm going to consider one which I think is quite plausible. And it rests on the assumption that Richard II commissioned this painting and that it is a reflection of his views on kingship and on his religious beliefs. But I do emphasise, it is just a theory, which you can accept or reject as you prefer. Let's start with his religious beliefs. And this interpretation is best seen by reading the diptych as we would a book from left to right. Let's look at the left-hand panel first of all. The figure that we see kneeling, wearing a crown and a red cloth of gold mantle, beautifully patterned, is King Richard II, who ruled England from 1377 to 1399. He is the first English monarch for whom we have a portrait that was done during his lifetime. In fact, we have three. This representation here, the full-size portrait of him in Westminster Abbey, enthroned with his coronation regalia, and then finally, his tomb effigy in Westminster Abbey, where he's buried with his first wife, Anne of Bohemia. Behind him stand three figures, kings and saints, to whom he was particularly devoted. Going from left to right, first we have King Edmund, king and martyr, who was the last king of East Anglia. He was murdered by the Danes in 869 after refusing to renounce his Christian faith. And he holds in his hand the instrument of his martyrdom, the arrow. He wears a green mantle lined with ermine, over a blue cloth of gold mantle patterned with birds, and beneath that a blue-sleeved robe. And he's wearing very bright red stockings. Next to him is King Edward the Confessor, who built the first Westminster Abbey, and who was made a saint in 1161, and his shrine remains in the abbey to this day. He holds a ring that was given to him by St John the Evangelist in the guise of a beggar. Now, although his clothing appears to be cream, the colours have faded over the years. The ermine-lined mantle was originally pink. Over a deep red robe, and beneath that again, a blue-sleeved dress. And then finally, there is John the Baptist, with his tousled hair and beard, bare feet, and wearing camel skins, with the hooves dangling over his arm and the head of the camel hanging discreetly by his left leg. He holds the Lamb of God, the Agnus Dei, the words with which he greeted Christ when Christ came for baptism. Now he touches the shoulder of Richard, because Richard was born on the 6th of January, which was not just the feast of the Epiphany, but also the feast of the baptism of Christ by John. So he regarded John as his patron saint. All the figures are standing or kneeling on barren land, with a forest in the background. This represents the wilderness of earth. The attention of all four is very much focused on the right-hand panel. And as we look to the right, we are blinded by blue, because what we see is the Holy Family, with the Virgin Mary holding the Christ child, surrounded by 11 angels. And Mary and the angels are all clad in beautiful ultramarine robes. Now this pigment derived from the semi-precious stone lapis lazuli, which had to be imported from Afghanistan at the time, so it was very expensive, and was normally reserved in art for the figure of the Virgin, but here the angels have been given the full treatment as well. And then the Christ child is wearing a blanket of cloth of gold. Now the angel to the left of Christ is holding a banner, and in this particular context, it symbolises the banner of Christianity. Christ is often shown holding the banner in resurrection paintings. In contrast to the barren ground of the left-hand panel, the figures on the right are in a meadow strewn with flowers, and this meadow represents heaven. All the flowers are symbolic. For example, the pink roses with their cut stems shown uppermost symbolise the purity of the Virgin Mary. The blue flowers, which appear to be violets, symbolise her humility, or if irises, her sorrows. The Christ child has raised his hands to bless the king, who in turn has opened his hands to receive this blessing. And the three saints behind him are presenting him to the Holy Family. So on this interpretation of the painting, here we have Richard II, who, when he departs this earthly life, will gain access into the kingdom of heaven. And he'll do so partly because of his faith. We know that he was a very strong believer. He prayed several times a day. He was a generous benefactor of the church. And he modelled his kingship on kings who are known more for their piety, such as St. Edmund and St. Edward, than for their military prowess. But first and foremost, he will gain access into heaven because Christ has given his life for all upon the cross. And though we see Christ as a baby in this picture, his crucifixion is referred to partly in the symbol of the sacrificial lamb held by John, and partly because in the halo above Christ's head, the artist has stippled, that is, applied fine dots with a metal tool, the crown of thorns and three of the nails that secured Christ to the cross. And Mary holds the foot of Christ to indicate where the nails will be driven through the body on the cross. As a result of his resurrection, as symbolised by the banner, Christ has put an end to death, and he has broken down the barriers between earth and heaven, which is physically represented by the hinges holding the two panels together. And this means that the three saints, Edmund, Edward and John the Baptist, who would have been shown on the right-hand panel in heaven, have been able to cross over into the left-hand panel, representing earth, and to plead on behalf of King Richard for his salvation. And it's interesting to note that on the tomb of Richard in Westminster Abbey, there is an inscription which he commissioned, in which there's a reference to John the Baptist praying on behalf of his soul, which is precisely what is happening here in the diptych. In summary, the religious interpretation of this painting is that when Richard has departed this earthly life, he will gain access into heaven through faith and through Christ's sacrifice upon the cross. Now let's consider the secular interpretation of this painting, which reflects Richard's views on kingship. If we look at the right-hand panel, we'll notice that all of the figures, with the exception of one, are either looking at or pointing at the king. The only figure who isn't is the angel to the immediate right of the Virgin Mary. But even that angel is looking in the direction of the angel on the right, who most emphatically is pointing at the king. And this is the angel who is stooping a little and touching the shoulder of the kneeling angel. X-ray examination has shown that the artist made very few changes to the underlying drawings. But one change the artist did make was that angel on the right, who had been previously pointing at the Virgin Mary and Christ. The artist lowered its finger so it is pointing unequivocally at the king. And all the figures on the left are also pointing at Richard, so he's the centre of attention. And if we focus on Richard, we'll notice that above his hands held in a gesture of prayer, he's wearing on his mantle a badge. And this badge is called the White Hart. This is the family emblem of Richard II. He adopted it from his mother Joan. It's thought he particularly was fond of this emblem because it was a pun, a rebus, on his first name Richard. Because the White Hart has a crown at its neck, a chain, and has pearls in its antlers. Therefore, it's a rich heart being worn by Rich Hard. Now, Richard was born in Bordeaux. He spoke fluent French, and so the French version of his name would have made the pun even more evident. And the White Hart is also shown in the pattern on his cloth of gold mantle. Now, what is more important than the poor medieval joke is the fact that Richard isn't the only one wearing the White Hart. If you look at the angels on the right-hand panel, all of them are wearing simpler versions of the White Hart badge. Now, in those days, if you wore the badge of a monarch, it showed you were his supporter. So just like the fans of a football team, the king has got the angels on his side. No bad position to be in as a monarch. Now, if you return to focus on the king once again, we'll notice that he's wearing around his neck a very ornate collar with a chain attached to it. And that is the collar of the broom cod, the pods of the broom plant, which was a type of gorse. Now, this was originally the emblem of the French king, Charles VI. When Richard's first wife, Anne of Bohemia, died in 1394, Richard decided to negotiate with the French king with a view to marrying the king's six-year-old daughter, Isabel. The couple were married by proxy in March 1396, and then the negotiations were concluded when the kings met at Ardres in France in October that same year, and Richard was handed over his seven-year-old tearful bride. Now, luckily, she had her dolls as part of her wedding trousseau, which hopefully made her feel less upset about being married to a man who was three times her age. Now, at some stage during these negotiations, the French king presented Richard with a gold collar of the broom cod, a symbol of the friendship between France and England, and then Richard adopted it as his own personal badge. Again, he may have been very pleased at the fact that it was another pun on his family name, because the Latin for the broom plant is Plantagenista, and from that we get Plantagenet, the family dynasty of Richard from 1154 to 1485. More significantly, if we turn to the angels, we see that they are wearing a simpler version of the broom cod around their necks. Yet another sign of the angels' support for the king. But the most poignant evidence of this heavenly support wasn't discovered until 1992 when they restored the diptych, and it concerns the banner being held by one of the angels. As we've seen, this could be the banner of Christianity, particularly symbolising the resurrection. But it could also be the flag of St George, the patron saint of England. In other words, the English flag. When the painting was restored in 1992, they discovered that the orb at the top of the pole of the banner had concealed beneath the centuries of dust and grime a picture of a castle on an island surrounded by a silver sea with a ship in full sail. And according to both literary and historical references, this represents the Kingdom of England. Now, we know that there was an altarpiece in Rome in the 17th century, made around the late 1300s, now sadly lost, which showed Richard with his first wife Anne kneeling before the Virgin Mary and offering her a globe with a picture of England as her dowry. So now the secular interpretation of the diptych becomes clear. Richard has handed over to the Holy Family his banner. Symbolically, he's offered them his kingdom. They've blessed it and they're in the process of handing it back to the king. So he will rule the Kingdom of England on behalf of the Virgin under her protection. And to seal the contract, Richard will kiss the foot of Christ being offered him by the Virgin. So Richard is divinely appointed to rule England. This isn't just portable prayer, it's royal propaganda. And the argument is taken a stage further. Now, we date this diptych at the earliest to 1395. And that's because it was in that year that Richard decided to combine the royal coat of arms with that of Edward the Confessor. Now, this combination of the two coats of arms can be seen on one of the outer panels. One of the panels shows a much larger and more lifelike image of the White Hart. The artist may have used a live animal as a model, because we know that Richard was given a white hart, which he kept at Windsor. As with the flowers in heaven, the flowers here are symbolic. The rosemary and fern are the personal symbols of Anne of Bohemia, Richard's first wife, and the irises and pimpernels, that of his second wife, Isabel. But the other panel, which is the most damaged of all four, when completed, showed a heraldic arrangement. At the top is a lion, then we have a cap of maintenance, red with a white lining, then we have a helmet made of silver gilt, and then finally we have a shield. And this shield combines two coats of arms. On the right-hand side are the royal arms of England and France, ancient as they were known, in use between 1340 and 1406, showing the fleur-de-lis or lilies and lions. And on the left-hand side, the mythical arms of Edward the Confessor, represented by the cross patons splayed at the edges and the martlets, which were mythical birds. So the combination of these coats of arms was first introduced in 1395, and that's why we give this as the earliest possible date for the diptych. Now, in 1395, Richard was 28 years old, and we know from contemporary sources he was bearded with a moustache. That's how he appears on his tomb effigy in Westminster Abbey. Here in the diptych, he's beardless and looks much younger than 28. And that's because Richard doesn't want to appear as he looked when the diptych was painted. He wants to appear as he looked in 1377. He's not just telling us he's divinely appointed. He's telling us when and where he received that appointment. When he was 10, crowned in his 11th year in Westminster Abbey. Indeed, this divine appointment is still reflected in today's coronation service, when the monarch is anointed with oil from the Holy Land to show that they are the chosen one set apart from their people. It was the only part of Queen Elizabeth II's coronation in 1953 that was not televised because of its sacred nature. And Richard's claim to have been appointed at his coronation in Westminster Abbey helps explain the presence of the angels and the saints in the diptych. He was crowned in his 11th year, hence there being 11 angels in the diptych, and the angels' significance may go beyond a mere number. Because essentially, they're secular angels. They wear rose chaplets in place of halos, and badges in support of the king, and the king may have been familiar with the pun first remarked upon by Pope Gregory the Great in the 6th century, when, on seeing a group of English slave boys in a market in Rome, he proclaimed, "Not angles, but angels. Not English, but angels." Or if you reverse the pun, "Not angels, but English." And just as the banner in the diptych may have a dual function, as the banner of Christianity and the banner of St. George, in other words, the Kingdom of England, it's possible that the angels have a dual role to play as well, as angels in heaven, but also as the English people on earth, supporting the king at his coronation in Westminster Abbey. And it's interesting that in the coronation procession, there were followers dressed as angels, scattering gold florins and leaves before the king, offering him wine, and a mechanical angel presenting him with a crown. The saints on the left also have a part to play in this argument. All three have chapels in Westminster Abbey, St. Edmund, St. Edward, and St. John the Baptist. Further, we know that Richard was crowned wearing the slippers of St. Edmund. He fell asleep during the service and managed to lose one of them and was carried out on the shoulders of the steward, still wearing one of the slippers. We know that he was crowned wearing the robe and the crown of King Edward the Confessor, who built Westminster Abbey, so he's specifically linked with royal coronations. And with respect to John the Baptist, when the king gave the manor of Aldenham in Hertfordshire to Westminster Abbey, in return for this gift, the monks of the abbey were ordered to perform a solemn mass with music in the chapel of St. John the Baptist every year on the anniversary of the king's coronation. So another link with the abbey and the coronation service. And a very important conclusion can be drawn from this statement. If Richard has divine authority to rule England, given him at his coronation, then he is answerable only to God and is not limited by the laws of this land, the principle enshrined in Magna Carta of 1215. In other words, it's a justification for the king's personal rule. Now, one problem I've always had about this theory is that if this was a piece of royal propaganda, who was going to benefit from it? Given its small scale, it was really intended for personal devotion. I mean, if Richard had intended it as a powerful statement of royal authority, he hadn't really chosen a very suitable message for delivering it. But the more I've considered Richard's reign and his methods of government, the more it all makes sense to me. Richard was a pious prince, but he wasn't a successful ruler, and the Wilton Diptych is a perfect illustration of why. Faced with political turmoil and social unrest in his kingdom, instead of trying to find practical solutions to the problems he faced, he shielded himself from them by focusing on theories of kingship. He even called upon astronomers to help him out. And he turned to artists to help create this image of a powerful, sacred and unassailable monarchy. Well, it may have brought him comfort, but it didn't make the problems go away. To be a successful monarch, you needed to connect with your people, not cut yourself off from them as Richard tended to do, and to establish a bond of trust, particularly with those powerful magnates on whose support you depended for strong and stable government. Ultimately, Richard lost that trust. At court, he surrounded himself with a group of close advisers, many of whom were personal friends. Those outside the charmed circle felt excluded and were angry. By a series of arbitrary and often cruel acts, Richard alienated and made enemies of the people he should have cultivated, at least as allies, if not friends. One of those men was his cousin, Henry Bolingbroke, the Earl of Derby. Bolingbroke raised enough support to overthrow the king. He was forced to abdicate in 1399. He was imprisoned in Pontefract Castle, and by February 1400, he was dead. Almost certainly murdered, probably starved, on the orders of his cousin, who became King Henry IV. After Richard's body was displayed in London to prove that he was dead, he was buried in King's Langley, Hertfordshire. So he was not only deprived of his crown, he was also denied burial in the church where he had received it. Now, the wonderful thing about the diptych is that we don't have to be interested in the history, heraldry or symbolism in order to enjoy this as a beautiful work of art. It stands on its own merits. It's such a pity that we don't know who the artist was. The trouble is that so much of medieval art in England was destroyed at the Reformation and the Commonwealth period. And of that art which survives by a known artist, there is none that is so similar in terms of technique and quality that we can say unequivocally, this is the work of that artist. But whatever their name or nationality, this was one of the most gifted artists of medieval times. Blessed with such superlative skills, talent, virtuosity, an artist who makes us marvel at the richness of the colours, the virtuosity and refinement of the technique, particularly in handling the gold leaf, and the intricacy and subtlety of the details. So let's consider briefly those two main areas of his artwork, the gilding and the handling of the paint. Let's start with the gilding. What is amazing about the gilding is that very few areas have been left plain. Most have been tooled for patterning or modelling purposes. The two inner panels have beautiful gold backgrounds, and the artist has first incised a grid so that the pattern can be applied consistently throughout using a fine dot punch. On the left-hand side, it's a beautiful floral pattern, and on the right-hand side, it's a foliate or a leaf design. The beautiful gold backgrounds acts as a perfect foil for the brilliant colours in the painting, notably the ultramarine. And in order to achieve the cloth of gold effect of the mantles of Edmund and Richard, the artist has used a technique called sgraffito. In the case of Richard, the artist has applied gold leaf, on top of which is placed a layer of red vermilion paint, and then the artist has scraped away the red to create the pattern of the broom cods encircling the white hearts. Then stippling has been applied over the gold to give the impression of embroidered thread. In the case of Edmund's mantle, ultramarine has been placed over the gold leaf, but in this case, because the pattern of birds appears to be identical, a cartoon has probably been used as a guide, which would have served as a stencil. And then the ultramarine has been painted around the edges of the pattern to reinforce it, and vertical lines to imply the folds of the material. So the skill in handling the gold leaf for decorative purposes is quite superb. But it's where the gold leaf is handled for modelling purposes that the virtuosity of the artist is simply breathtaking. When gold leaf is tooled and catches the light, it takes on a three-dimensional appearance. The artist exploited this to the full. And what light? Not natural light or electricity, but candlelight. The flickering flame would catch the tooling and make it stand out in the picture. So the artist has stippled the outline of the crowns of Edmund and Edward so they stand out from the plain, untooled halos. The artist has stippled the crown of thorns and the nails of Christ's halo so the candlelight would literally illuminate the central belief of the Christian church. But the pièce de résistance is the blanket round Christ's body. The artist has used dense stippling where the folds of the material project, as at the knee, and left it plain where the folds recess. So you really do believe there is a body beneath that blanket. Let's turn now to the artist's handling of paint. The artist was a master of the medium, egg tempera. Egg yolk used to bind the pigment. It produces brilliant colours, but dries very quickly. So once you apply it, you can't manipulate it. So it's important to mix beforehand and only mix the amount you need for one session. The secret was to first lay a luminous white ground, then on top of this, build up thin layers of paint or glazes. And because egg tempera is more transparent than oil paint, the light from the base will penetrate the layers, producing rich and vibrant colours, which have stood the test of time. I mean, the pigments have faded over the years. I've already mentioned the robes of St. Edward that look cream now, but would originally have been a pink mantle over a red robe. And the roses in the chaplets of the angels would have been scarlet rather than pink. But when you consider that the diptych is over 600 years old, the pigments have kept their colours remarkably well. And the painting has a freshness about it, as though it were painted yesterday, which for me is always the mark of a masterpiece. Now, in some areas, the artist has exploited the full purity of the unadulterated colours of some of the pigments, notably the ultramarine of the Virgin Mary and the angels. Just using different shades of the colour to give the impression of the folds of the material. Then in other areas, the artist has used quite a complex mixture of pigments. For example, the leaves of the rosemary branches on which the white heart was lying on the outer panel were painted with a mixed green, consisting of 3 to 4 different pigments. And that same mixture has also been used for the green robe of St. Edmund on the inner panel. And it's the use of these complicated mixes of paints in different areas of the painting that have led experts to conclude that the diptych was probably the work of a single artist. The other great advantage of egg tempera is that it produces fine, crisp, definite lines, allowing an artist to include the most intricate details in a painting, such as eyelashes or fingertips, and the artist has exploited this to the full. Indeed, it is the subtlety and refinement of the details that take this painting onto a new level, that transform it from a work of delight to a work of sublime beauty, a true masterpiece. Now, if you're able to visit the National Gallery and look at the Wilton diptych and spend time looking at some of these fine details, then obviously that's marvellous. But I understand that may not be possible for many. So I would urge viewers to use the magnifying features on your phone or tablet or laptop or computer to look at details which are not always clearly visible to the naked eye. Just to give you a few examples, take a look at the fingers and fingernails of the saints and kings, the toes and toenails of John the Baptist, his tousled hair and beard, contrasted with the very bushy grey beard of King Edward, and the more refined and elegant beard and moustache of King Edmund. Look at the angels, their rosebud lips and cheeks, their eyelashes and eyelids, and the beautiful rose chaplets, and their curly blonde red hair, beautifully complementing the shade of King Richard's. Even the Virgin and the Christ child have that shade of hair. If you look beneath the beautifully pleated veil of the Virgin, you can see her hair. She even has strands out of place. And notice the different coloured eyes of the figures. The Virgin Mary and Christ both have blue eyes, but other figures have grey, others have brown. And spend time looking at the beautiful flowers and foliage, notably the roses with their stems cut and shown uppermost. I never tire of looking at the Wilton diptych. I find something new every time. After more than 20 years of studying and appreciating this painting, I'd never up until now noticed the head of the camel still attached to the skin around St. John the Baptist's body. And when I take time looking at this painting, I find myself getting so absorbed in all the details that I lose track of time and am oblivious to what's going on around me. I understand that this is being in the zone or living life in the moment, attaining a true state of happiness. Be that as it may, I often imagine Richard II kneeling before the Wilton diptych in a chapel in Westminster Abbey, illuminated by candlelight, and I see him getting so absorbed in the richness of the colours and the fine attention to detail and the glistening gold leaf and the strength of the messages of the sacred nature of kingship and his hope of salvation, that for a moment or two, he is completely oblivious to the world outside him, to the troubles building up in his kingdom, troubles that would ultimately lead to his overthrow and death. Talking of which, we need to return to King's Langley, because the story doesn't end there. When Henry V became king, he ordered the reburial of Richard in Westminster Abbey. So Richard was laid to rest alongside his first and most beloved wife, Anne, and their effigies placed over their tombs, showing them just as he had wanted, holding hands. And on the eve of the Battle of Agincourt, Henry reminded God of that act of reconciliation, so the sins of his father should not be held against him on the battlefield, courtesy of the words of William Shakespeare. Not today, O Lord, O not today. Think not upon the fault my father made in compassing the crown. I, Richard's body, have interred new, and on it have bestowed more contrite tears than from it issued forced drops of blood. Well, as a result of that act of reconciliation, we can see two of the three representations of Richard I mentioned at the beginning of this talk. Firstly, the full-size portrait of Richard enthroned with his coronation regalia, a powerful reflection of his belief in the divine nature of kingship. And secondly, his tomb, an expression of his hope of salvation, achieved by faith and through Christ's sacrifice. And then we can visit the National Gallery to see the third representation of Richard, where these themes of kingship and salvation are powerfully and yet subtly combined. That sublime masterpiece, the Wilton Diptych. Well, I do hope you've enjoyed this talk, and I hope to make more podcasts for you in the new year. All that it remains for me to say is I wish you a very Merry Christmas and a very happy, healthy, and peaceful New Year. Goodbye.